you actually don't have to even be a manager. I think people can lead from any role in the organization, just different contexts, of course. I think great organizations, you see that happening at every level, at every role. And those principles and values, whether it's around how you collaborate, whether it's around how you give feedback, whether it's how you take risks and stretch people and so on, right? Whether how you make hard decisions and work through those. Those are the things that, you know, when you think about people going from different companies, if you ask them to describe what's different beyond the actual sort of physical attributes of the business and so on, right? Like, what's different about how people work together, right? They talk about these things.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fello, a software platform that helps managers and their teams collaborate on meeting agendas, track action items, and turn chaotic meetings into productive work sessions. Check it out at www.fello.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fello.app. Today, I'm really excited to introduce you to Jevon Sue Lennox. Jevon and I had a really interesting conversation. He's worked at companies like Stitch Fix and Square, Blue Bottle Coffee, McKinsey. Today, he's the chief people officer at Incitro. And, you know, Jevon's had a lot of experience in all roles in HR, but one of the things that I think he's had a particular passion for is onboarding. Really, how do you get people from zero to one? How do you get them from, hey, welcome to the company, to let's be super productive and really be a part of the culture there? And so he's had a chance to see this at a bunch of different companies. And so we walked through a lot of examples, but it was particularly fun to hear the story of what went on at Square. He joined when the company was around 400 people, and there was this onboarding program called Square One, where people would really do a one-week onboarding, and all the senior leaders, including Jack Dorsey, founder and CEO, would participate. And at the end of that 1 week, everyone was so culturally bought in. But when he came in, what he really wanted to do is say, it's not just about being culturally bought in. How do we get people really productive within the company? And so we talk about what they did and how they transformed, or rather really evolved, that program to be what it is today. And of course, because of the unique vantage point that Jevon has had working at companies that have had different types of employees. So for example, at his current company Incitro, there are software engineers and machine learning engineers, but there's also scientists that work in the lab. And it's very interesting that he's had this viewpoint of working at companies where there's been these different types of workers. And just hearing the learnings that he's had about how do you take those different types of workers that have very different day-to-days and bring them culturally into the mix together has been super instructive. This all around, very tactical, very, I think you're going to take away a lot from this conversation that you can apply to your day-to-day. And of course, before we get into the conversation, I did want to remind you, we're so close. If you still haven't done so, it will take just a second. A 5-star review will really make our day. Would really appreciate it if you could do that. And I also wanted to say that the Super Managers Slack channel, where you have a lot of other super managers, we're discussing the episodes that are coming in. And one of the things that we're going to start doing, which I'm very excited about, is we're going to have a way for you to get advice from other people who listen to this podcast. Everyone has stuff that they want to get other opinions on and feedback on. And if you're interested about that, we're just about to kick that off as a new way to discuss with other super managers on our Slack channel. So if you're interested, send us a note to supermanagers@fello.app, and we would love to get you into our Slack channel. And with that said, and without further ado, here's Jevon Sue Lennox on this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. Jevon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, very excited to do this with you. I know you've had a pretty extensive leadership career. I've worked at a lot of brand name companies like Stitch Fix, Square, McKinsey, and today you're the Chief People Officer at Incitro. So we dug into that a little bit before we press record. But maybe you want to just give the audience, I thought it was like a very, very cool thing that you guys are working on there. Just give us like a quick overview. What do you do at the company?
Yeah, InCitro is a company that is applying machine learning to transform how drug discovery is done. Drug discovery is a very, very hard process. It's a process where something like low digit percentage success rates of drugs making it through the pipeline and getting to patients, often costing up to $1 billion or more in development. And it's getting worse over time. So the industry is actually getting less productive over time. And so if you think about what a huge opportunity as a business to really transform something that is clearly not working well, and also something that's really needed by, you know, humanity. I was literally pitching to a senior exec candidate earlier this month and saying, you know, come here and save the world because we need to do this. Someone needs to do this. And so it's a really inspiring mission and vision, and honestly, really, really fun people and organizational challenges, because our business, as you might guess from what I described, we have a ton of amazing biologists and chemists focused in the lab. We have amazing machine learning engineers, software engineers, product managers building the technology. We've got great GNA folks supporting across. And they all come from pretty different walks of life, really different expertise, really different ways of working. And you have to knit it together. And I told my CEO in my interview process, you know, you've got a recipe here where you're hoping 1 + 1 = 3. But if you don't really build intentionally, 1 + 1 is not even equal 2. Because there's such disparate groups of people that the inability to really align around how to work together in a really transformative way will be really hard, right? We have to build that for them.
Yeah, lots of very interesting challenges. So I think that really sets the stage very well. But let's start from the very beginning. Do you remember, if we were to go back in time, when you first started to manage and lead a team? One of the things we like to ask about is those early mistakes. Do you remember some of those very early mistakes that you used to make?
Yes, many. I started managing in my kind of early and mid 20s at McKinsey. So I had done a couple years as a junior consultant, as one does, and then actually moved over to the people side of McKinsey into the group called Firm Recruiting, and was focused there. And in retrospect, it was actually a blessing. So the first team members that I led were people that are actually very different than me, which is a harder first task as a manager, but I think ultimately a really important task as a manager to learn how to do. And so the key mistakes I've made as a very naive young whippersnapper in management was, A, I think the first instinct if you're trying to manage well is to manage through the golden rule. So you manage like, well, this is how I would want to be treated, and this is what motivates me, so I'm going to manage others through that. And it turns out that most people are not you. In fact, I guess all people are not you. They're not motivated the way you are. They don't come from the same set of life experiences, right? And so applying the golden rule is certainly better than not doing anything and just kind of managing out of gut instinct. But it actually isn't super successful because you're not really meeting people where they are and really thinking through how to problem solve, how to help them be their best selves and do their best work. So I think they call it the platinum rule, right? Actually go into them as they want to be done. And I think it took me probably a year or two to really understand that fully through a lot of stumbles.
Yeah, super interesting. And I actually had never heard someone call it the platinum rule. So that is, I guess, in opposition to the golden rule, where it's all about how they would want things versus how you would want things. Yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah, what an interesting term. So do you remember an example of maybe, you know, you thinking that someone wanted to be managed a certain way, and, you know, you then learned that maybe that wasn't the way, and like what an example was or how you came upon that realization?
Yeah, so I started the consulting side, and the consulting business, you take people straight out of college, historically straight out of college, straight out of grad school, generally earlier in career, earlier in life, right? And so tend to come from specific academic backgrounds and tend to be driven, I think. I mean, honestly, we call them gunners, right? You're just super driven. You always want the next brass ring. You probably don't have a lot of other things in your life, actually, that are distracting you from your career aspirations, right? People just typically don't have families yet and so on, right? And so that was who I was. And so naturally, I sort of thought, well, these are a bunch of other people at McKinsey. They must be driven the same way. Even on the consulting side, I actually think that's not a great assumption. But certainly as I moved into outside of consulting into the recruiting group, you know, two of my first team members that I started working with were senior recruiters They'd never been on the consulting side. They're really deep in their practice and their craft, if you will. They were later in life. One, I believe, already had a child at the time. So they were thinking about their work in a different way. And when I say that, I don't mean that they thought it was less important or that they didn't care or so on, right? But how they thought about their career success, how they thought about driving the work, just was had really different reference points. And, you know, I think my initial instinct was to say, well, I'm the manager. I'm going to lead through my reference points and push, push, push. And I do think part of management or great management is offering your reference points to your team in a way that supports them and helps them, right? But there is a nuance of being open to their reference points or actually seeking them out and understanding them, right? And thinking about these reference points combining in this amalgam of insight. And I think, you know, it took me some hard lessons of, you know, kind of leading in a very monolithic way, right? Of showing up in a very specific way, of giving feedback in a very specific way, and then kind of being like, why is it working? why aren't they responding? Why is it getting better? Why are they changing direction and so on? And I think, you know, doing some self-reflection of saying, gosh, I'm kind of being an idiot. I am really leading in a way that is actually pretty self-centered. I mean, to your point, the golden rule, the difference between the golden rule and the platinum rule, though I have two young kids, starting with the golden rule is not a bad place to start, I think, right? But it is actually self-centered, right? It sort of assumes that your worldview, your way of being motivated, of doing things and so on, right, is the way and that others should conform to that. And so this idea of the platinum rule, right, of just leading through empathy and really starting from this other place doesn't mean that sometimes you're not going to give hard feedback, doesn't mean that sometimes you're not going to disagree and push pretty hard on something, right? But it is this anchoring around, where is that person starting from? How can I connect with them in a way that will really break through and that we can kind of get to somewhere really great together? That, I think, was something, again, that honestly, those two team members in many ways really taught me. I would also say that like most things in life, I think I relearned that lesson in different ways over time. And so hopefully you get a little bit better at the lesson each time, but it's something that I don't think you necessarily just nail one time.
Yeah, it's a very good point. The other version of this I've heard is sometimes people want to do the opposite of something that they've experienced. So for example, they may have had a boss before they started to lead a team and say it was a terrible boss. And they thought that the goal of being a boss is being the opposite of what they experienced. And so they do the opposite. And so, but yeah, it's always this pendulum and you eventually figure out that everybody is, like you said, very unique. And it's about the empathy and doing things the platinum way. And that's a term that I might use now going forward. So I really like that. So since we're talking about McKinsey, I did want to dig in a little bit. So yeah, McKinsey is definitely, at least from an outsider's perspective, we look at it as being a very competitive place. And so we talked a little bit about how it may have shaped the way that you view people and culture today. But are there other lessons that you take from your time at McKinsey to where you are as a chief people officer today?
Yeah. And as a longtime McKinsey person, I might clarify, it actually didn't feel that competitive inside. I know the perception from the outside didn't feel that way. I do think there are a lot of competitive people who go to McKinsey. But the culture inside, to me, in many ways, that you're most competitive with yourself because it is a place which has a very, very high bar and you get a lot of feedback. And so that leads people, I think, constantly just sort of feel like you're always being told this is going to be better and what you could work on and so on, right? But as long as the business was growing, there wasn't actually, particularly at the kind of mid-levels, a cap. So, you know, multiple people can get to that next role because the business is expanding, there's more projects and so on. But I do think that element of kind of continuous improvement, and there is a pressure to that, right? I think aligns with a little bit of maybe your outside perceptions. The things that I really took away from that time, a couple of things I was thinking about as I was prepping for this conversation. The first is McKinsey really defined a client mission or a business mission, if you will, and a people mission, and talked about how they were both vitally important to the success of the firm. And that generally you were looking for decisions, ways of working, et cetera, that really brought the two together, right? The two shouldn't be in opposition a lot of the times. There were occasionally times where they're in opposition. You have to talk about how to navigate those, right? But the idea is that those two missions are both really important and you should be kind of bringing both lenses to any given conversation or situation. And I think that's a really great way of thinking about building great organizations and managing, right? There are goals that you're accountable for. There's output and outcomes that you're trying to create. And that you're also trying to hopefully make an amazing experience for your team members. And when I say amazing experience, I don't actually mean that every single moment is super happy-go-lucky and that you're, you know, going to happy hours every single day or so on, right? But I mean that when they look back on that time, they think, gosh, for that time on that team, for that time working with that manager, I grew so much. I achieved so much more than I thought I could. I learned so much more, right? Hopefully I had a really fun time doing it too, right? So I think that's not, that doesn't matter at all. But thinking about the people mission and the people responsibility of a manager is kind of equally commensurate to like delivering, and that the two can go together. That's a huge thing that I took away from that and still kind of guides me to today. The other thing I would think about is a lot with McKinsey and my lessons there is when you're thinking about leading teams and building great organizations, you want to build what I call infrastructure. And so what are the ways that you hold meetings or the ways that you hold one-on-ones? How do you coach people on promotions and career development? What are the people processes you have? So all these structures, right, that support managers, that support employees, that support an organization, like this is how we do things. These are expectations. And then there's culture and behaviors, which is you can have the most amazing set of things on paper that you're supposed to do. And if they don't come to life in a way that's powerful people and people don't see it being role modeled and lived every day, it doesn't really matter, right? And so you really need to have both. And I think McKinsey at its best really did have both. There's a ton of rigor, a ton of structure, constantly iterating on how do we develop people? How do we move them faster through? How do we get them to be incredible at the things that we're asking of them? And a lot of conversation constantly around what's the culture that we're creating? How do we hold our leaders accountable? What are our leaders' responsibility to behave in ways that are visible and inspiring to the entire team? McKinsey, to be clear, is not perfect. Definitely has made, especially recently, a bunch of mistakes. But I did really think I see some pretty incredible things there around recognizing that those two pillars are important. As a chief people officer now, I think of myself as one of my key responsibilities as an architect. So I have particular responsibility for building those structures. But every manager has an opportunity to bring that culture and those behaviors to life every single day, right? Like you, all of us have probably, unfortunately, been in situations where teams side by side in the same function, engineering, sales, product, right? Like are having very different experiences based on what that manager is doing, even though they're in the same ecosystem with the same structures, right? So you as a manager have, you know, tremendous power actually to shape that experience in a really positive way through the small things that you do every day.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you almost, I guess, phrase it as a dual mandate, which is, you know, obviously we have some goals and some objectives and we need to deliver certain output, but there's also a responsibility, at least from a manager's perspective, where you want to create an environment where it is a meaningful experience. There is growth, or there is, you know, people can look back on those days and, you know, look back with, I guess, a smile saying that, yeah, that was a great time, not because we partied and we did this, but also maybe there is some of that, but there's also, oh, I grew a lot. I learned a lot in that experience. And I also really liked the way that you described your role as chief people officer to be an architect of a lot of those systems. And when you think about those systems, what kind of systems are you generally thinking about? What do you feel are some of the processes that you architect in the organizations you work with?
Yeah, so at a very basic level, you're thinking about how you bring people into the organization, how you set them up for success, how you keep them growing and inspired over time, and all of the processes and structures that actually allow that to happen, right? So that, you know, I'm at a relatively small company now. I joined at under 150 employees in January. And so we are in this next phase of building, right, a company that will be doing all of those things in ways that we find effective and inspiring to the team. And so it's really across the people stack, if you will. It's everything around hiring. We've just rolled out a new interview training talking about how to create a really balanced and equitable interview process that's efficient, but also really getting a great read on people and candidates on whether they'd be a good fit for the role and whether they'd bring new perspectives and add to the culture that we're constantly trying to strengthen at Incitro. We just did a big project over the summer around onboarding. This is something I've worked on at a lot of different companies. And this idea, coming back to the dual mission piece, I think about onboarding new employees as there's two big things you're trying to do. The first is you are trying to accelerate them to full productivity as fast as possible. That's a very mercenary view, but it's actually kind of important to say out loud, right? Because you hire great people, they want that too. They don't want to be sitting around.
Yeah, they don't want to waste time.
They want to contribute, right? Like all of us have made great hires, and what are they asking the first couple of weeks? Put me in, coach. Like, I want to do the things, right? And for them to get in the game, you got to teach them the rules. You got to show them where the bases are, right? Because every company, there are different attributes of the business and the organization. And so the more that you can think about giving them that guided tour, I kind of call it, of the information they need, of the context they need, of the skills they need potentially, right? That they can get to that full productivity as fast as possible. They're happy. The business succeeds. It's less of a tax on the team around them and the manager, all good stuff. The second piece beyond the full productivity piece is really bringing them into the culture of the company, really bring them to the values of the company, really inviting them to strengthen it. So I'm a huge proponent of the evolution in language over the last few years of culture ad, because great companies are constantly evolving on culture. And there are, I think, universal values that should scale and, you know, sort of carry through from chapter to chapter. But what I talk a lot about as cultures evolve is the way that those values manifest at different scales, as you go global, right? As you go remote, obviously have to look different. The practices that allow those values to actually live and breathe in and really drive your business necessarily evolve as the business evolves. And so by that nature, there's this delicate dance as you bring new people in of really communicating those values that you stand for, really welcoming them in, because hopefully you've actually done that in your interview process. So you're not sort of finding out in the first week whether they actually aligned to that. But also saying, like, this is a living, breathing document. And so the way that culture can keep strengthening is for people to add their perspectives on, for this next chapter, here's how we make those values ultimately successful. And so I could go on and on, but those are the kind of examples of the things that you have to architect at each of these different stages to say, for the business where it's at today and where we want to go for the next couple of years, what are the most effective interventions, is what I call them, that we can choose to make to help the organization and each team member reach whatever aspiration that we and they have for these different things.
You know, I like the phrase that you use, which is most effective interventions, because it definitely does feel like interventions at, you know, at some points in time, but it's also part of the overall architecting of the life cycle of employees. And, you know, it was very interesting for me, you know, having a video conversation here. I guess not everybody who is listening in was able to see this, but in particular, when you started talking about the onboarding, you were very like, I mean, it was very obvious that you were very excited about onboarding. And I know you've worked on onboarding at a bunch of different companies. So why don't we start with Square? I'd love to learn about, you know, some of the things that you learned about onboarding at Square. And maybe we can then, you know, basically also take that conversation into culture ad as well. But what did you learn at Square? What was special about onboarding there?
So Square, the onboarding program that I walked into was pretty spectacular in many ways. It was called Square One, and it was a one-week program. And there were a bunch of different sessions each day around different parts of the business, around the history of the company. And really senior leaders would come in and lead them at that time. So I joined about 400 employees. We're still at the scale where you could kind of do this. Our CFO, Sarah Fryer, would come in and lead the finance section, right? Our head of hardware engineering, Jesse Duergusker, is still there actually, would come in and lead the session on hardware. So it's pretty incredible. And then you'd end the week with what we call the Jack Walk. So meet our CEO founder, Jack Dorsey, at the Gandhi statue at the San Francisco Ferry Building. So there's a beautiful statue of Gandhi looking out over the water. And you'd meet them there first thing Friday morning. And he would talk about why he founded Square with this mission to really help small businesses start and thrive in a world that is often stacked against small businesses, and how that was good for society, how it was good for economies, how it's good for humanity. And obviously in this context of Gandhi of saying, you know, this is the change that we seek in the world, and you got to go be that change. You got to drive that change. And then we'd all walk with Jack together back to the office, which was, you know, probably like about a half hour walk from the Ferry Building at that time. And you could ask Jack any question. So at the end of Square One, you know, if you hadn't already drank the Kool-Aid on Square, you would drink the whole gallon container.
That's awesome.
I mean, it was so inspiring. You're so connected to the leaders. You're kind of like, yes, I'm going to be here for 10 years. Like, do everything we can to drive this mission. what was really missing, and I actually took over the team that was responsible for onboarding, right? That was then thrust directly into the challenge, was the productivity part. So you ended the week totally all in on Square, drank all the Kool-Aid, loved the culture, loved the values. If I'm an engineer, I'm like, I don't know the tech stack. I don't know how to ship anything, right? If I'm a salesperson, I'm like, who are our customers? What do I do tomorrow, right? And so there's this whole pillar that was missing, although the first pillar was just honestly one of the most spectacular ones I've ever seen at any company. And so we then had to build the other side of it. And so that's exactly what we did. We thought about, well, what are all the things that someone needs in their first few weeks to be successful? What are the ways in particular that a manager, because a lot of the time it's the manager, needs to prepare to give them the context of what they need to know? And then we created something that we called a Kickstarter project. And so the manager would think through, A, what's the shape of their first few weeks in terms of the conversations that they need to have? Who's the buddy on the team that can support them beyond the manager to be a little bit more accessible, to ask questions at a peer level? And what's a Kickstarter project? Something small enough that someone could actually make traction on it and ideally finish it in a few weeks, but something also important enough or, you know, would be appreciated enough by the rest of the team to, it's not a throwaway thing, right? It's actually like, oh gosh, we've been wanting to get to that for months. I'm so glad someone took care of that. That bug is, we just haven't gotten to that bug. So like that, someone finally took care of that bug. And so it's something that you can really celebrate together as a team. And of course, you know, part of learning is actually doing work. So it's not just reading all the things, but how can someone just start engaging with the business, engaging with their responsibilities of their role? That actually also helps them learn. And so really figured out how to build that together. Again, partly through what are the ways that we can support managers and make that as easy as possible. So really creating the templates and support and ways of thinking about it, make it sort of, hey, I don't have to spend hours on this. I can actually just be really thoughtful on a Friday afternoon and knock it out. And then again, thinking through there are places where the business actually had to do more to further support the managers. So every engineering manager shouldn't be explaining the entire tech stack to every new engineer. That's something that we can do in a session for all new engineers that engineering leaders can drive and get some scale effects. So this dance again between the structure, the architecture, and the individual manager behavior is this dance that can keep kind of changing steps, if you will, over time.
Hey there, just a quick pause on today's episode to let you know that we'd really appreciate you helping us spread the word about the Super Managers podcast. If you're enjoying what you're hearing so far, dial into your podcast app of choice, whether that's on Apple or Android or Spotify, and just leave us a quick review. Now back to the interview. It's really interesting to hear the evolution. And so you started with Square One and it was 1 week. So what did it turn into? So when you were done, nothing is ever really done, but when you were more done, how long was it and what did it look like in terms of just when you would think of someone as having completed onboarding?
I would say we ended up doing a very big push around the first 30 days. And so I think a common way of thinking about it is 90 days, which I think is, you know, a pretty healthy anchor, but probably the biggest lift in focus was that first 30 days. After we sort of architected this sort of where I think we can really call it Square One 2.0, which is quite a mouthful, but Square One 2.0. And the first big push was around engineering onboarding, actually, because again, we were hiring a lot of engineers at that time and hearing a lot of feedback that we really need something to accelerate their productivity because they love Square One from a culture perspective, but they really are not getting the information and the context and the tools that they need to jump into the work. And so we built all of that. That was, again, really focused around a month. And then actually I moved out of a people role over to the sales team and led sales operations for Square as we were building out our first sales team and built a 1 month sales bootcamp. So similarly, we'd bring in fresh new sales reps. We would teach them how to sell at Square. We teach them all of our products. And we would kind of have a ramp up over the first 30 days of them shadowing other sales reps, then other sales reps shadowing them, where they're taking their first pitches, right? And giving them feedback. And so really thinking about this kind of peer mentorship model, if you will, over that time to get them to, at the end of the 30 days, it's not that we expected them, they were, you know, exactly like a sales rep that had been there for a year, but it probably was that moment of saying like, okay, little bird, like go fly out of the nest, right? And we'll keep an eye on you for the next couple of months. But at this point, it's a little bit more of a typical manager feedback relationship versus the full court press that first month looked like.
Yeah. So I think there's so many lessons that you can take away from looking at something like this. But one of the ones that just maybe stood out to me was, and I know there were 400 people, and of course, maybe the original Square One doesn't scale if you're you know, 40,000 people, but still to get all the senior leaders in the company to be part of that process, you know, I think there are companies that are much smaller than that where senior people are not involved in the process. And, you know, I think that says a lot because I think it just puts weight behind, you know, the fact that this is that first week is really important. It's the first impression in the company, and to, I guess, level set people from a culture perspective is that important that you had every single or almost every single, you know, senior leader be part of that. So that's super interesting. And of course, like you said, it sounds like your role in many of the organizations that you've been at is to make sure that that 0 to 1 stage, you know, 0 to super productive is, you know, as fast and as efficient as possible. So very interesting to see how you put that together. I also like the Kickstarter project. So the Kickstarter project is makes a lot of sense, especially for engineering organizations. But did you have something similar, for example, when you were like when you took on the sales team and helping them get from 0 to 1?
Yeah, the sales team was there's a little bit of a variation on the Kickstarter idea because with the sales team, you know, they're all ultimately trying to get to, I've got, you know, a target I'm trying to hit. I've got a bunch of potential customers that I'm working with, and I want to feel fully knowledgeable and confident that I can go out there and have those conversations and close some deals. And so the Kickstarter project in that case wasn't necessarily like a specific project per rep, but more this learning journey over the first 30 days or so of how do we give you the different things at the right time in terms of knowledge and capabilities so that you can layer them and kind of remember them, right? Because if we gave everything to them, and I tried a version of this, if you give everything to them in the first week, it's just complete overload, right? You can't as a human take all of that in, or most of us can't take all that in and retain it. So there was actually quite a bit of an art to thinking through what builds on what. What should they get first? What should they get second? What's the first conversation that they should hear with a customer? What's the first thing that they should try with a customer? Which part is easier than that, right? So we'd have them kind of jump into a certain stage of conversation, shadowing more experienced reps. But outside the sales team and outside of engineering, we did apply the Kickstarter project to other areas. So, you know, on the G&A side, you know, whether it be finance or sort of more analytical roles, it might be an element of, hey, we've got this new data set that we're just starting to work through, and someone needs to get in there and just like assess the state of the data, start doing some cleanup, organize the data in the ways that we know that we can actually drive analysis or think about what kinds of analysis we want to drive with that, right? And so that would be an example of something that's tangible that actually someone pretty fresh can do and do that's valuable to the team. But those would be really specific to each team and sometimes even each person and manager to really work through that. And that took some coaching. Actually, a member of my team spent a pretty good amount of time working with managers to really help them think through, you know, what is an appropriate Kickstarter project that really sets someone up for success.
Yeah, it sounds like you were really, really purposeful in this whole process. I mean, when you say things like, you know, yes, we could dump a whole bunch of data and make it accessible to them, but some things build on others, so which one should come first? And just making sure that everybody has a win very early on, because that momentum definitely builds on each other. If you feel like you're successful in the first few weeks, you know, you're likely to have more successes, and it kind of builds on. So I really like that. One thing that I thought would be interesting to talk about is I know you worked at a bunch of different companies, like, say, Blue Bottle Coffee or Stitch Fix. And I know, for example, at Stitch Fix, you had some hourly and some salaried employees. And I know at the current company you're at, you have software engineers, and you also have, I guess, people who work in the lab and scientists. And so it sounds like in your career, you've had the opportunity to work at companies where there's been different types of employees. And one of the things that I think a lot of companies struggle with is how do you get these different type parts of the organization to be, A, interact with each other so they don't feel like they're in silos, and kind of make the culture a cohesive one. So since you've had the opportunity to do this at a bunch of different places, I'd love to get your thoughts. What have you learned about, you know, different types of work that happens in a company and getting people to be more cohesive culturally?
Yes, I love this question. And I feel like I've run headlong into it at a number of different organizations. I think it comes down to, when you think about cohesive culture, really defining a set of values and principles that are really going to unite you in terms of how people work together, how people treat each other, how people lead. And when I say lead, it doesn't, you actually don't have to even be a manager. I think people can lead from any role in the organization, just different contexts, of course. But leadership is, you know, I think great organizations, you see that happening at every level, at every role. And those principles and values, whether it's around how you collaborate, whether it's around how you give feedback, whether it's how you take risks and stretch people and so on, right? Whether you, how you make hard decisions and work through those, hopefully with speed. Those are the things that, you know, when you think about people going from different companies, if you ask them to describe what's different beyond the actual sort of physical attributes of the business and so on, right? Like what's different about how people work together, right? They talk about these things. They talk about how people communicate. They talk about transparency. They talk about how leaders show up day to day, right? So those things are the things that I think that's what you want to be cohesive, right? What is really, really terrible, I think, for people is when they see that function over there or this business unit or that country, you know, sort of group, and they say, gosh, it feels so different, right? And on these dimensions, it feels so different in terms of how people are treated. It feels so different in how meetings are run and the tone of those meetings. It feels so different in how decisions are made, right? What I think is a red herring is then to say a cohesive culture is universally consistent. Because I think that is unfortunately not going to be the case. Some of the examples that you brought up, at Stitch Fix, we had thousands of part-time stylists working from home, thousands of warehouse workers working from distribution facilities, 1,000 or so at that time, corporate team members working in a whole different variety of roles. Blue Bottle, you might guess from a coffee company, it was about baristas. And it was about folks at headquarters and D&A roles. And it was about people working at the roasteries. Those are radically different jobs. Those are people coming from radically different life contexts, very different experiences. And so actually, I think one of the things you sent over in a question is this question of microcultures versus cohesive cultures. Like there are microcultures in those different contexts. And I don't actually think those microcultures are necessarily bad, but the microcultures have to rest on a consistent foundation of those cohesive cultural principles and values, right? And then from then on, of course, a life as a barista is super different than life as a chief people officer or as a marketer or as an accountant at headquarters. But we should be united by those same things that are true around how we treat each other, how we think about helping the business grow, how we think about customers and so on. And part of that, I think, making sure that that empathy exists, which I think is another uniting cohesive thing, right? Is those businesses at Blue Bottle and Stitch Fix, of really trying myself and encouraging others to literally walk in those shoes, right? To spend time working in the cafes, to spend time in distribution centers. At Stitch Fix, we ask people to style so you can actually get in there and style for clients, just like our stylists do, and see what they're feeling, see the challenges that they face, understand their feedback better. So the things I think you can do to bridge the microcultures to really have a safety net to make sure that they're not diverging in ways that are problematic. But I think once you've really established that cohesive set of cultural principles that span the entire company, acknowledging that there are differences in people's context and their work and their lives, and that some variation in the way that those cultures come to life effectively actually is healthy, right? But it's a bit of a tension. I'll give you another example. So when I was building out Square's first sales team, the company, gosh, was probably about 5 years old at that point, 5 years old about that point. And unlike most tech companies at that point in time, Square had become a really successful company with no sales team. So most, you know, kind of business to business companies, which technically Square is, they serve small merchants, you know, you would have a sales team selling to, you know, this big company and that big company, right? And closing the deals and so on. But Square started really, really small, right? Square started with your aunt and my grandma doing their garage sales on the swipe B card, right? And so on. And so they built this incredible business all from that side where you didn't need a sales rep. People were just signing up online. And so when we said, hey, for Square to keep evolving, to be successful, and for us to be able to compete for these bigger businesses that are not going to sign up online, they have to talk to a sales team. We ought to build a sales team, which from a business perspective, you're okay, that makes sense. There shouldn't be much, you know, kind of challenge. A lot of very unhappy people. And the reason why is they said, my stereotype of a sales culture, Glengarry Glen Ross, right, is always be closers, lots of swearing, ring the gong, like salespeople are jerks. They're going to ruin our culture. We have this amazing culture that we've cherished and built through Square One and all these things, right? And you're going to come in, build out the sales team, and you're going to destroy Square's culture. This is like literally some of the things that were said out loud. And so I said, okay, well, we need to do it for the business. And so it feels, and I love Square, and I certainly don't want to kill the culture. And so it feels like my challenge is, how to build a sales culture that is consistent and cohesive with Square more broadly, but acknowledging like it is a different culture. Their jobs are really different. Their compensation was structured completely different than the rest of the company. They have a lot more compensation at risk, right? Because that's part of the job. And so by that nature, how do you create a team, an environment that is specific enough to help them succeed, but doesn't diverge or conflict with the broader environment that was so inspiring and that they're a part of, right? Which honestly, it was a really fun problem. And so we really dug into it. And what we built that I think the team was so proud of at the end, as we're working together, we talked a lot to leaders of other sales organizations that we admired. We hired some great people from the outside. We heard their perspectives and so on. And I think what we really discovered was the sales organizations that we admired most, that we wanted to sort of emulate, there is a competitive element, but similar to what we're talking about in McKinsey, the competitive sales org that we thought were great that would work within a Square context, sales reps were more competitive with themselves. They didn't want other sales reps to fail. They wanted to win. They wanted to win for sure, but they didn't want to do it at the expense of other team members, right? It wasn't sort of all or nothing. It was this idea that everyone actually wanted to succeed. I actually want the whole team to succeed. I would still like to be at the top of the leaderboard. But there was this collective sense of community and connectedness and helping each other out. And so that's what we really sought to build that we thought was consistent with Square's culture. But there is an element of a sales culture that is more individual. It has to be, right? People are just accountable for a kind of output that is so different than I think these more collaborative, product-driven roles, right? Where you're just, your success is so intermingled with everyone else's day-to-day, right? And that's a different kind of challenge. So I can go on and on about this. I'm very passionate about this topic, but those are some examples. And again, I think something that even managers can think about of where, what is this broader culture of the company that is really inspiring that we should make sure that we as a team are living up to? And what are some specific things of the work that we do and the challenges that we face that we may actually have to problem solve a bit fresh? And that's okay. Just as long as you're thinking about it in context and in tango with the broader company.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you put this all together, which is it's okay to have microcultures. Like that's completely fine. And as long as, you know, there's a base layer of cohesiveness that makes a that will make things connected. And of course, I love just the tactical, allow people to walk a mile in each other's shoes and try different areas of the company to really get a sense for and build empathy. I think that was super important as well. You know, one thing is, and then you obviously ended off by saying, and managers can actually know this and have a part in this too. And I know when we first started chatting before we hit record, you were talking about how these days it's so much harder to be a manager and it's become a lot harder than say it was 10 or 15 years ago. And here I, you know, you added on this extra little bit of these days managers also have to manage microcultures and make sure it, you know, matches the whole culture. So this is like yet another thing that managers have to do. But maybe tell me why you think being a manager is way harder today.
Yeah, I think when I started my career, not to sound like the career grandpa in this conversation, but, you know, a manager, you needed to get your team to deliver. And I think, you know, you should be nice to your team was probably more the general vibe. I think some managers went above and beyond to really inspire their team and so on, right? I think some organizations really pushed on that, but probably the general zeitgeist was, you know, be nice, do well by your team, deliver, and, you know, kind of good things will happen. And I think the world has just gotten a lot harder, right? I think when I think of what we're asking managers to do now, so first of all, when you think about just all of the dialogue, again, I think eye-opening around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and talking about how we want people to be their best selves and bring their full selves to work. And we want to create an environment for everyone to thrive. And we want to create an environment where people are really aware of and curious and open to feedback around how they can be better and contributing to that kind of environment creation and so on, right? And it kind of, a lot of that rests on the manager. And that's really, really, really hard. Right? It's taking some of the things that we talked about at the start of the conversation of centering on the other person, the platinum rule. So like even kind of, I think, a more challenging space, right? Because the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion are far bigger than companies, right? They hit on deep social elements. They hit on deep history. There's just a lot there, right? And so any given manager trying to account for that, trying to navigate it, especially for things that are outside of their own experience and understanding, Even if you attend a bunch of courses, right, even if you're most conscientious, it gets really hard. It's really, really hard. I say that from even my own experience as a manager today of holding myself accountable to that work. That is really, really hard. I think coaching our team members through careers and development is so much harder than it was 15, 20 years ago. 15, 20 years ago, it was generally, here's your career path at this company. Hope you like it. Here's the next step. Go. And now you could be thinking about switching functions at that company. We're much more open to that than we used to be, right? We think about a lot more lateral movement, I think, across companies than we used to. The tenure of people at companies continues to decline. And so I think part of actually being a great manager is really being honest about the fact that people may be looking outside sooner than one would hope. And having honest dialogue about that, talking about the pros and cons. What I've seen over and over again in the last few years, I think the managers who are more effective at retaining their best talent have really open and honest conversations with that talent along the way about moments where that talent might be looking outside, might be actively thinking about this opportunity. Help me think this through, right? And what I often say, to make it super practical, what I often say to my team members, first of all, when I'm building a relationship with them, I say is, if you ever start thinking about leaving, give me a first shot. Don't just tell me. They're going, give me a first shot. Tell me about what you're thinking about. Tell me what's driving the conversation. Tell me what that opportunity is. Give me a shot to work through it with you. And then the thing that I commit to you is, I first and foremost want you to be successful and happy. I then would prefer it to be on my team at the company over time, as long as things are going well and so on, right? But at the end of the day, if you're not going to be happy and this is not the right thing for you, that's not good for me and that's not good for the company either, right? And so let's have a shared set of stacked hands that if we can trust each other on that, if you can trust me to be vulnerable with me and say, I'm really thinking about, you know, other things, I'm really unhappy, or I'm even curious, maybe it's not even that level of just, you know, sort of unhappiness, then I commit to you that I will come to you with respect and to say that, well, you should obviously know that I'm going to have interests of the company and my team at heart, that they will not override, that I will see, I ultimately, like, I care about you as a person. And fundamentally, I do believe this, if someone's just going to be unhappy in a role, it's not going to be good for anybody. And so that is, I think, a more inspiring and more meaningful way of leading and managing. It is so much harder. It is so much harder. Nothing has an answer, right? Everything is fluid. Everything is specific to that person. Everything is specific to a context. And so I could probably go on and on, but there's so many examples of what we're now asking managers to do to be successful. I think, again, if you lean into those skills and lean into that success, it's thrilling, honestly. It's really, I think, really a wonderful way to feel connected to your team members and really invested in their success. But it's so much harder. It's so much more complicated.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job of outlining why this is so hard and why I think we're, you know, close to 120 episodes in the Super Managers podcast, and why every time I do an interview, I still learn something new, because it is actually that complex and there's just so much to do and so much to learn. And it's always evolving. You always have to continue to be aware of what's going on in the environment and make sure to evolve as well. Jevin, this has been a really insightful conversation. We heard really cool stories about your early days at Square and how you built Square One to be Square 1.2, and everything about the concept of building most effective interventions, microculture, building a cohesive culture across the board, and of course, why management is so difficult. So one question that we always like to end with is, for all of the managers and leaders constantly looking to get better at their craft, are there any final tips, tricks, or parting words of wisdom that you would leave them with?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think the first thing I would say is just to have empathy for yourself. Managing is hard. And so part of it is that you're going to make mistakes. Part of it is that you're not going to be perfect. But I think great managers have a growth mindset. They just recognize that this is hard, and that part of it is this is a craft that you will always be getting better at. And so if you give yourself that space, I think everyone will be better off for it. And just again, you gave me the request to make things practical, so I'll make it practical. I, with one of my recent teams, had a moment at an all hands where someone asked a question, and the tone of the question I didn't love. And I was also kind of having a bad day, like I was having a rough day. And so I probably didn't bring the best energy into the all hands. And I kind of snapped a bit in my answer and gave a response. And honestly, the content of the response was right. but the tone of it was not. And then we get out of the all hands, and then one of my team members who I trust gives me feedback and says, not one of your best moments, and also people are chattering. And so then I went through all the human reactions, and I got defensive, and then I got upset at myself, like, why did I do that, and so on, right? And I was talking with her about, well, what's the right thing to do here? And I said, do you think it would be overkill for me to address the team? And she said, I don't think it would be. And I thought about writing an email and so on. And ultimately, I decided to create a video. And so one take, I just wrote down some talking points, and I just kind of videoed myself and said, like, hey, team, I've gotten some feedback. Today was not one of my best moments. Let me just talk it through. Here's where I was at. My answer to the question, I stand by. This is why. The way I answered the question, the way I brought it to you, I do not stand by. And I hope you'll give me some grace and forgive me. I apologize, because my intention was not to sound frustrated or resentful of the team. That's like the last thing on my mind. That's my stuff. But I did want to stand by the answer, which was, in some ways a hard answer. I know it probably disappointed some people, and this is why, and so on, right? And the response I got back was just like unbelievable. I think someone emailed me back immediately that night and said, Jevin's back. and so I think my advice is just like, you're going to mess up. And I think there are a lot of things that you actually be surprised that you can recover from as a manager, but it's really showing up again quickly with self-awareness, with vulnerability as a human being. And a lot of team members will really respond to that.
Jevin, that was probably the best answer. And that's like a lot to say for my parting question, the final words of wisdom. I think, 120 episodes in, that was probably the best answer. And what a great, that was awesome. What a great story. And a great show of leadership. This has been great. Thank you so much for doing this. And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.